A little Waltzing Matilda in honor of the movie The Day After, which it uses that piece in there toward the end. And excellent movie. It changed not just television history, but also our own. We'll talk more about that coming up in just a second with Nicholas Meyer, who directed it. First, you may remember that it wasn't that long ago that we had an earthquake in Haiti. It was a 7.0 earthquake on the Richter scale, and it was devastating. Well, we're getting word, even just initially coming in here, that a magnitude 8.5 earthquake has happened in Chile. That's a huge earthquake, and it has happened within only a few miles of some major population centers, about 210 miles from Santiago, Chile, which is the largest city in Chile. But Concepcion, which is the second largest sort of population area in Chile, is only 56 miles from the epicenter of this 8.5 Richter earthquake. Talca, Chile, which is also a large area in between Concepcion and Santiago, is just 68 miles away from the epicenter of this. So we don't know much more than that. These are all preliminary reports, but as you can see just from those numbers, it has the potential of being extremely devastating to those areas of Chile where many people live. Now, we'll be grateful that it's only 210 miles away from Santiago. It could still have an effect, and there can still be more aftershocks. We'll let you know more when we know more, but that's all we could tell you now. An 8.5, as it's being judged now, 8.5 on the Richter scale earthquake magnitude affecting right now in Chile, and no news yet about these cities that are right in the path, but I'm sure we'll get more before the show is over. In the meantime, we'll resume our view from the bridge with Nicholas Meyer, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So, Nicholas Meyer, I just did a little checking there just in the meantime, and the largest earthquake ever recorded in the history of recorded earthquakes, according to one source here, was actually in Chile back in 1960, almost exactly 40 years ago, almost exactly 50 years ago, I should know better, and that was a 9.5 in Chile. This is an 8.5 earthquake, but
to imagine an earthquake that big.
In 1960, they say that this 9.5 earthquake made it the most powerful recorded earthquake in history. A main shock so large that the wave traveled more than 3,200 miles to the core of the Earth. That's all we can tell you for now. So the view from the bridge is the memories of Nicholas Meyer, both as a Star Trek director. We were talking about his work on The Day After and having to fight for the final movie. But the interesting part was, when the sponsors had heard that this movie was becoming controversial and that there were many voices like William Buckley that were standing up against the movie, ABC decided to run the whole second half of the movie without commercials because, well, they didn't really have any commercials to run in there anyway. So why not just say, well, now the second half of The Day After will be presented commercial free? And it was a huge hit.
No one would have, and no one did anticipate the size of the hit. I remember sitting there with my then girlfriend and watching it in November of 83 and saying to myself, geez, if this wasn't my movie, would I stick around for this whole thing? Well, you know, by that time we had also been on the cover of Time and Newsweek, and I'd gone on Crossfire, and an editorial in the New York Post had basically accused me of treason. It said, why is Nicholas Meyer doing Yuri Andropov's work for him? Yuri Andropov, being the then semi-senile head of Russia at the time. So, we were a very hot button item, and shrinks were advising parents to control their children's viewing, and church groups were going to watch it with everybody holding hands. And I just wondered, while I was watching it, could this really sustain anybody's, not just their interest, but their sort of fear level? It looked pretty upsetting to me. So I was very astounded when the following morning I was told that 100 million people had watched this movie in one night. I was really amazed. I was not prepared for that. And then the reporters, as reporters will do, went out for a sort of instant survey, snapshot of the public reaction. Did this movie change your mind about nuclear war, yay or nay? And then came rather gleefully back to me with their microphones extended and said, according to our survey, your movie didn't change anybody's mind about nuclear war one way or the other. What do you have to say to that? And I wasn't sure what to say to that, so I sort of shot from the hip and I said, listen, in the first place, I think it's probably too soon to find out what people thought of this movie. I don't think people change their minds about things overnight. And B, they probably wouldn't admit it if they had. And C, who's going to say, oh, yeah, my mind was about nuclear war was changed by a TV movie? Didn't sound very plausible. And they also, I found myself wondering, what do people really believe anyway? Short of being on your deathbed or having a gun pointed at you, we say what we think we believe. We say what we would like to believe. We say what we would like others to think we believe. But what is our most profound conviction? We may not be able to access in the sort of normal course of events. But as it turned out, there was one person whose mind was changed by the day after. And that turned out to be the mind of the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan had come into office believing in the notion of a winnable nuclear war. And apparently, and we know this from several sources, including his own memoir, where he talks about the day after, that the movie got to him in a very profound way. It upset him a lot. And he began to rethink this whole idea of the winnable nuclear war. And it was sometime later that he went to Reykjavik, Iceland, and signed the intermediate the treaty for the intermediate range missiles with Gorbachev, much to the dismay of his conservative backers and constituency, who felt, that he'd given the store away and so forth. It was also around this time, we were in the cutting room, I remember, when he came on the radio with his sort of Star Wars initiative, the Space Shield.
Right.
That was his other, I guess, reaction, or at least his reaction before he saw the movie, and afterwards it was to sign this treaty. I spoke with Reagan's official biographer, Edmund Morris, who wrote the biography Dutch.
Right.
And Morris was living in the White House for 3 years with virtually unlimited access as Reagan's biographer. And he said the only time he ever saw that man really upset, depressed, dismayed, was after he saw the movie the day after.
About 100 million people, you said, saw it, and it made me think, although it is amazing that a very important person saw it and changed his opinion about the idea of the efficacy, say, of a limited nuclear war or the future of nuclear deterrence. 100 million people, that's amazing. How, you know, you wonder how long did it take for something like Gone with the Wind to have been seen by 100 million people? Or how many decades did it take for Citizen Kane, recognized by many to be, like, if not the, at least one of the greatest American movies ever made? How long did it take for Citizen Kane to have 100 million viewers?
Well, just out of curiosity, did Citizen Kane have 100 million viewers? I ask as a point of information. I don't know, and I would agree with you. It is one of the greatest movies of all time. But I'm not trying to blow my own horn here. It's mystifying to me that 100 million people watched the day after. I'm just wondering if anything like that have seen Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm.
Well, I just, over the, whatever, 6-7 decades, yeah, you'd think that by now, internationally, 100 million people have seen it, but it took a long time, I would think. And that is, it's mind-boggling, and that you make a movie, you couldn't have built enough movie theaters to show it in one night for 100 million Americans, what would have been at the time, what, slightly less than half of the U.S. population watching the same thing at the exact same time.
It's true, and it's also true that the record is never likely to be broken because there's simply too many channels. There are too many venues to round up. You know, back in those days, you know, there was NBC, CBS, ABC, and I don't know what else, but not a lot.
No.
It is certainly an astonishing thing. I personally bemoan all these channels and the sort of fragmentation of an audience. I think there was something to be said, never mind whether it was my movie or The Sopranos, or the idea that the whole country came together on certain occasions to watch certain shows, even if it was The Wizard of Oz being broadcast on Thanksgiving. That gave at least me a sense of being part of a community. And right. One of the things I think we forfeit with all these different channels and the streaming and the different venues is that shared experience, which I think was somehow good for you. It was salutary.
ABC had to set up all these 1-800 numbers to help for people who were having a panicked reaction to it, or for them to express their outrage. After the movie ran, I remember so well, I was in college, and I watched Carl Sagan and William F. Buckley debate what they just saw in the day after.
And Elie Wiesel and Henry Kissinger, that was the most widely watched edition of Nightline. But don't forget, before that Nightline edition went on, the White House insisted on putting someone on television to tell the whole country to calm down. And that was the Secretary of State, George Shultz, got on television with Ted Koppel, who said, you know, Mr. Secretary, is this the way it's going to be? And he very emphatically said, no, Ted, this is not the way it's going to be. And then, you know, sort of tucked the country into bed with grandfatherly reassurances.
Is there any truth to the rumor that Ronald Reagan himself had sent you a list of things that you could or couldn't put in the day after?
No. We may have gotten some cutting suggestions from the White House after the president screened the movie. What did happen, and I believe this was before he saw the movie, but it might have been after. I'm not 100% sure. But David Gergen who was then the White House press secretary, convened a meeting in the Pentagon of the Joint Chiefs and showed them the movie. And a friend of mine who's in the government or was in the government, connected with the government, told me this story because he was in the room and he hadn't realized, because we hadn't been in touch in a while, that I had directed it. So there were the Joint Chiefs in a screening room in the Pentagon with David Gergen, and they ran the movie. And my friend said to me, "Nicky, if you wanted to draw blood, you succeeded. There wasn't a titter. There wasn't a murmur. Those guys just sat there like they were turned to stone." Mm. And at the very end, David Gergen said, "Now the president wants to know what we're going to do about this movie." And my friend, who was there, as I say, in a kind of advisory capacity, said, "Well, you know, let me lead off by saying that a childhood friend of mine turns out to be the director of this movie. And one thing I can tell you, you know, right away, he's not a communist. He's the most capitalistic person you'll ever meet. And number two, if I were you, I would not challenge this movie on a technical or technological level. I wouldn't try to sort of prove that it's inaccurate on this point or that point." And that's when they sat around and decided that someone would have to go on television when the movie was over to reassure everybody. That's what the White House wound up doing, and it wound up being George Shultz.
You know, I know that your part of your directive as a director was to keep the movie from becoming a Poseidon Adventure-like movie where it was all about the disaster, or for it to be a disaster movie. And you really wanted the focus to be the day after. What will happen afterward? What will we do? And I find it ironic that on the cover of the DVD that is still available for purchase or rental, it is the moment. And the movie's called The Day After, but it's the moment of this giant flaming mushroom cloud that's on the cover of the DVD.
Well, I can hardly blame them. I mean, I think putting The Day After over a mushroom cloud, you know, says, okay, there's what happened, and the movie is going to be about the day after what happened. I don't see the issue or the difficulty. In fact, I sort of see the inevitability of that kind of thing. The movie was written by a writer named Ed Hume, H-U-M-E, and it wasn't so much that I was given a mandate not to turn it into the Poseidon Adventure, because I was given a script. And Ed's script really, as I say, was set in the heartland of the United States. It wasn't set in the halls of government or power. It wasn't set in a big city where a lot of movies are set. It was set in the farmland of Kansas and Missouri as to how ordinary people, ordinary Americans, were coping or incapable of coping with a nuclear war.
Well, I understand that. If the cover, when I look at it, it looks like it could be a Michael Bay movie. That's all. I think there's something much more nuanced and profound about the movie than the cover would indicate. But I get what you're saying, and we'll leave that there. There's more to it, though, in the book, The View from the Bridge, Memories of Star Trek and a Life in Hollywood. We'll open up the phone lines to grab a few callers for Nicholas Meyer before we go to open lines for the rest of the night at the top of the hour. We'll give you an update on this Chilean earthquake, too. More details are just coming in. And I have a couple of questions still about Star Trek to get to, but you can, too. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. Coming up tomorrow night, the Poisoner's Handbook. There was a time when people were able to get away with poisoning. In fact, many poisons were available just over the counter. You could just go into any drugstore, get some of the most poisonous materials ever, and you could use them to knock off somebody, and nobody would ever know. That is one of the earliest reasons why these crime labs started to be developed, to try to catch poisoners. That was how prevalent the problem had become. We'll talk about that tomorrow night. And then the side effects from that was they started to find out how poisoned we all are by our environment. This was as true 100 years ago as it is today. We'll talk about the poisons that affect us all tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. The View from the Bridge tonight, memories of Star Trek and a life in Hollywood. The phones are ringing. We'll get to as many as we can before the top of the hour with Nicholas Meyer. And an update on the earthquake in Chile. They have downgraded it from an 8.5 magnitude earthquake to an 8.3 magnitude earthquake, but it is still affecting the same areas. Now they're saying the epicenter was just offshore, 60 miles north-northwest of many of the larger population areas, or even closer, 75 miles away from Concepcion, Chile, about 200 miles away from Santiago. But we don't have any word yet on tsunamis. We don't have any words on damages. I don't think any of the pictures have made it back yet, but we'll give you an update when we do know something coming up through the course of the show. We just know that it has happened, and now it's being listed as an 8.3 magnitude earthquake. That's still significantly more than the one that devastated Haiti. And it is, you know, just part of the story of The Day After, the most watched TV movie of all time. 100 million people watched it, changed the president's mind on nuclear war, and it kind of changed the way the country thought about nuclear war. Gave it, well, if you remember the story earlier, gave it context. But there's also some very cool work on Star Trek we didn't get to the last time we visited with Nicholas Meyer, so we'll get to that coming up next. And your calls, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponett. Well, let's get to a couple of your questions for Nicholas Meyer on Coast to Coast. Jeff is in Ferguson, Missouri, on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hello, Ian and Nick, real honored to speak with you both.
Thank you.
And just one quick reference, Ian, to your music that you played earlier.
Yeah.
I think Matilda was connected to On the Beach in 1959.
Well, there's a reason why I played it. Nicholas, you want to explain Waltzing Matilda and On the Beach?
I also have a question, too.
All right,
go to your question.
I'm sorry. The two-part question is, with today's political environment, could The Day After be remade? And second, there was a footage I read. There's something I read about footage or script about the football players or the sports jocks and fighting against the science people at the college for the remaining food stocks. Was that footage ever shot?
No, I don't know anything about that footage. It certainly wasn't in the script, and we didn't shoot it. But the other part of your question is, I think, quite a problematic one. I think somehow positions in the country have so hardened ideologically on both sides that the idea of a network trying to put on such a show seems to me as though it would be very, 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 very difficult. Maybe one of the cable networks could do it, but I don't think such a show today would be possible on a network.
The music, Waltzing Matilda, played it at the top of the hour. Yes, it was in the post-nuclear drama On the Beach. Was that an inspiration for you when you were doing The Day After?
Well, I saw On the Beach, and I saw Failsafe, and I saw Dr. Strangelove. I saw all these nuclear-themed movies, and with the exception of Strangelove, which passes itself off as a black comedy, I think that going back to what I said before, people who are so terrified of, and rightfully so, I might add, of the whole, you know, prospect of a nuclear war. There were sort of the masochists who went to see On the Beach or who watched Failsafe, And then there were the other people who simply ignored it. And I think to the degree that movies like On the Beach were, quote, inspirational, it was showing me in a way what not to do, that the thing I loved about Ed Hume's screenplay was that it essentially masqueraded as something very banal. It didn't lead with its ideological or thematic punch. It was about all these regular Midwestern people doing what they would normally be doing until the moment they got fried. And in that sense, I didn't want it to be portentous like On the Beach. In fact, the movie has no music to speak of other than the opening credits, where I took some music by Virgil Thompson, the great American composer, and put it over views of Kansas farmland, later to find out, to my delight, that Virgil Thompson was born and raised in Kansas City. And he once said that all his music was an attempt to describe the city by the River Platte. But otherwise, there is no music in the movie, because I didn't want to goose anybody's emotions. I didn't want to, be accused of trying to sort of manipulate things. We were just going to show a nuclear war, and you could make up your own mind about what it meant. So, yes, I was familiar with On the Beach. No, I didn't want to do another version of On the Beach.
First-time caller line, Perry is in Santa Barbara on Coast to Coast. Perry?
Hi. Hi, guys. And this is – thank you, Ian, so much. And, Mr. Myers, it's an honor to really just speak to you. And
oh, you're very kind.
It's true. You. When I was 16 years old in Westwood, California, at the theater complex over there, when I saw The Wrath of Khan, and it was absolutely breathtaking. It really was. And,
Thank you.
Question to you, and real quickly, Ian, if you have time, please talk about Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. That was an awesome movie, too. But my question to you, Mr. Meyer, is in the original concept of The Wrath of Khan, there was supposed to be scenes in there where Kirk and Khan actually physically fought instead of the space telephone calls, you know, between the video conferences between the two ships. Was any of that ever filmed? And I wish you could extrapolate on my question.
It was no fight between Kirk and Khan was ever filmed. In fact, I hadn't even remembered all this until I guess I was reading Bill Shatner's book about it. And then I was reminded of something that I had forgotten, which was the whole idea that I think it was Bill Shatner had, that he and Khan should duke it out. And that seemed to me so predictable and so corny in a way that I must have vetoed it. I must have just said, oh gosh, haven't we seen that movie? And I don't think I realized actually until very late in the game that Kirk and Khan never actually meet in the course of Star Trek II.
As long as I was sort of putting some callers on before I asked you about The Undiscovered Country, which was the original title for Wrath of Khan, you had a chance to use it for Star Trek VI. We're talking with Nicholas Meyer about the book, The View from the Bridge. But, you know, what's interesting about that movie is you do what you did so well in Wrath of Khan, in that you use, in this case, you use words from Hamlet, and you talk about, you use a sort of Shakespearean framework for The Undiscovered Country, which just, it works so well. But that you also, you had, is at least as it's said, is that the is Star Trek VI is sort of a metaphor or an allegory for the Cold War, for the fall of communism, which brings us back in a way to the day after. Can you talk about that?
Well, when we were thinking about making a sixth Star Trek movie, of which Leonard Nimoy was to be the executive producer, and somebody said, "Do you have any idea for a sixth movie?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, Leonard, you know, has something up his sleeve, and he's going to come and talk to you." So I was vacationing on Cape Cod, and Leonard came to visit, and we walked up and down the beach, and he said, "As you know, the Klingons have always been our stand-ins for the Russians. And as we look about us, the Soviet Union is collapsing like Alka-Seltzer. And what if we made a movie about the collapse of the Klingon Empire? And who am I if I have no enemy to define me?" And with me, typically, all you need to do is prime the pump. And that was just about all I think he needed to say. And then suddenly I said, okay, I get it. We start with an intergalactic Chernobyl. The Klingon moon explodes, and suddenly their primary energy source is not there anymore, and the empire is going to collapse, and Gorbachev, whom we called Gorkon, my screenwriting partner, Denny Martin Flynn, called him Gorkon, is coming to meet the president of the Federation to arrange the evacuation and redistribution of the Klingon population, and Kirk is assigned to escort him through Federation space to his rendezvous, but Kirk hates Klingons because they're responsible for the death of his son, and so he doesn't do a very good job, and the Klingon chancellor is assassinated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It all came pouring out of me, but it was definitely intended to reflect events that had recently begun to unfold in Russia. And it is also true that when we were editing the movie, we'd finished shooting it, and it included, as I say, the assassination of the Gorbachev character. While we were in the cutting room, there was, in fact, a coup in the Soviet Union, and Gorbachev disappeared, and nobody knew if he was alive or dead for several days, and everybody was very frightened. But also at Paramount Pictures, they were saying, my God, you predicted this. Your movie, which has not yet been released, but you actually anticipated the Soviet coup, which was absolutely true. And we were very, very shocked. I also think we had the decency to be relieved when Mr. Gorbachev turned out to be unharmed. But after the movie was out, you know, 6 months, I was having my teeth cleaned, and my dentist was telling me how much he loved the movie. And I remember saying, well, that's great, and thank you. And how about we predicted the Soviet coup? And he said, what? And I said, well, you know, the Klingons are supposed to be the Russians, and blah, blah, blah. I explained the whole thing, and it was a long pause. And he said, wow, I guess I'll have to see it again. You know, and we worried that we were being too obvious.
Yeah. You know, actually, while I have you on that, I went to the a trivia page about Star Trek VI. And it says a couple of things I want to run by real quick, because actually somebody mentioned this to me.
There's a trivia page about Star Trek VI?
Well, let me read you some of them. Ready?
Yep.
That you personally had to pay the actors in the dinner scene because none of the cast wanted to eat the food served to them in the there was the blue colored squid and the other stuff that was on the table.
Yeah, so that's true. They didn't want to eat the food, so I had to shell out $10 to get them to eat a mouthful of it. But they're actors, you know, so $10 was $10.
It said $20 in the trivia. You're saying only $10. It said
you had. I said the trivia is probably right. We're talking about events a long time ago.
So it says you had to pay William Shatner $340 to finish the scene eating the food.
That is not true.
17 shots. No, no, right. You don't remember that.
Well, the number of shots may be correct, but I don't think he stuck it to me for $300. More of a gent than that.
In Star Trek VI, the line, guess who's coming to dinner, mm-hmm. which was a reference to when the Klingons are going to be coming on board, mm-hmm. that was originally a line that was written for Uhura to say it, but Nichelle Nichols refused to say it, so you gave the line to Chekhov.
Correct.
Correct?
That is true.
But she found that offensive, or?
Well, I think it was intended to be offensive. I think one of the things that the movie does, which I think troubled a lot of people during the making of it, I know it troubled Gene Roddenberry. He was very, very upset with the script, was it depicted a world where prejudice still existed. And more to the point, it was anti-Klingon prejudice, so that people who were part of the Enterprise crew, whether they were black or white or Asian or African-American, were behaving in exactly the same way that bigoted people in other times have behaved. And I think that's what upset Nichelle so much. She didn't want to, you know, be talking the way white people had talked about black people in times gone by. And I can also tell you that Brock Peters, a lovely, lovely actor who played Admiral Cartwright, has a long speech about Klingons, you know, coming into Federation space, turning into or proving themselves to be the alien trash of the galaxy. And the sentiments in this speech were so repugnant to Brock Peters that he couldn't memorize the whole speech. We had to film it in sections because it was so hard for him to say.
Well, that brings us to our regularly scheduled time. I know you've got duties in the morning as dad and husband, so I leave it up to you. Do you want to just call it quits here and say thank you for all that you've done for us already, or do you want to stick around and take a few more calls?
I'd love to, but I do have to get up very, very early. I'm sorry.
Not a problem at all. We totally understand that. Well, we say thank you to the people who were waiting. We got on as many as we could. The View from the Bridge, coming out soon in paperback then. And who knows, maybe made into a major motion picture, directed by Nicholas Meyer, the director of Star Trek II and Star Trek VI and so much more. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thank you so much, Nick. Have a great night. And thank you, everybody, too. Coming up then, we'll go to open lines. We'll clear these out. We'll go to open lines coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.